The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week, I talked about how in doing this practice of meditation or practicing Dharma, Buddhism in general, there is a interesting play or balance between making our own efforts in practice and allowing the practice to work on us. Or we make our own efforts, we show up, and then something begins to unfold, which is a little bit difficult to to claim as that we're making happen. It's more like that we create the conditions, and we put together the conditions, and then certain things begin to unfold and to occur. And it's many years ago, there was a movie called The Field of Dreams. I had this little, you know, the one line that remains in our culture from that movie was, "Build it and he will come." And some person built a baseball field in his cornfield. And people thought, I don't remember so well the movie, but I guess he thought it was kind of strange, middle of nowhere. But he believed if you build it, they will come. And so all these kind of old players, ghosts of the old players, would come and play baseball in his field. So it's not just ghosts that come to us, but rather we build it, we create the conditions for practice. So one of the, like meditation practice, we make the one of the conditions is we sit down and take a meditative posture. And things unfold a little differently in our lives. If we sit down, just take a simple meditative posture, maybe close your eyes, then if you just continue going shopping and watching TV and the computer and all the clouds, right? It creates a different condition. Sitting quietly is a different condition than being busy. And that different condition makes a difference. And it might seem at first that it doesn't make much of a difference, but over time it can make a huge difference. And some of you know the analogy I like of if you take two parallel lines, they never meet. That's the definition of parallel lines. But if you ever so slightly nudge one of the lines towards the other, then, or nudge it away from the other, then over time, the two will either meet or they'll get further and further and further away. And so, though the first, you know, if it's just a slight little budge, you can go 100 miles before you see a difference, two lines. But eventually, given enough time, it becomes a huge difference if you push them apart. So our lives can take different directions over time that are very different than if we, by making some small choices now. And so sitting quietly and meditating and doing it every day, for example, creates the conditions for our life to be nudged in a different direction than if we just continue our life as usual. And that difference over enough time can make a huge difference. You might say that if you meditated every day for 5 years, like that's forever. You know, you can't imagine into the future. But if you think back 5 years, most of you probably those 5 years went pretty quickly. And so in 5 years, this current 5 years will go quickly. And so it's not such a big, you know, but it can make a big difference in our lives. So some of the conditions that we put into place in Buddhism is we put the condition of ethics in place. So to live ethically, that creates a very different condition for our lives than if we don't. The condition of being generous. Generosity does something to the heart, maybe not initially, but slowly over time, where we develop kind of a disposition to be generous, it creates a very different feeling inside of us. It lightens things up, it creates an openness, it overcomes you know, being closed and tight-fisted with our things. It's a very beautiful thing to do. It is a very different condition to investigate what's happening, notice what's happening in our lives, than not noticing what's happening in our lives. Just let our lives kind of keep unfolding and doing, thinking what we want, doing what we want. But if you kind of really are cognizant, this is what's happening now. That creates a very different condition for our lives, and things unfold differently. For one thing, maybe you wouldn't do certain things because you see clearly that this is not worthwhile, I'm not interested in this. Or you might see that there are opportunities to change what you're doing for the better. Or by simply knowing that what's happening, it creates space for our inner lives. And one of the remarkable things about making space for inner lives is our inner lives begin to relax, open up, soften, rectify, reveal themselves in a way that they can't if we're always busy and doing and doing and doing. And one of the great purposes of meditation is not to do anything, per se, but rather to simply make space or to allow for ourselves for what's already happening for us, but to see it clearly. Right now I'm thinking. Right now I'm feeling something. Right now I'm hearing. Right now I'm reacting. Right now I'm judging. Right now, whatever we're doing. And it creates a very different condition for inner life than if we just keep riding and being involved with all the thoughts and reactions and feelings. So if we create the condition, something begins to change and unfold. And that which unfolds, if you allow it to unfold a lot, can make a big difference in our lives. And it's best, you know, it doesn't really feel like I'm the one who's doing it. It's more like you're allowing it to happen and come through you. And so one of the little clichés in Buddhism is that those who practice the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. That there's something about practicing mindfulness, practicing being present, being ethical, being generous, and all these good kind of Dharma qualities, that if we devote ourselves to it, there's something in the mix, something in the way things work, that then our lives are supported. And so we're protected, we're supported. And this is one of the things that I feel very strongly about my own life, is that as I gave myself over to Dharma practice, did my meditation practice, and not just kind of to meditate once a day or something, but try to find a way to let my whole life be informed or be led by or be guided by the Dharma, which for a big part meant try to be present for my life as I lived it, to notice what's happening, to recognize what's going on. That as I did that, my life seemed to always work out for the better. It was remarkable. Now, why? Maybe it's just a coincidence, you know, that happened that way. And now, you know, because I can't really see the causal connection to say, yes, I did this, and therefore these good things happened in my life. But it's, you know, pretty clear over and over again that that all this wonderful stuff happened. In myself, I became a happier person in the process of practicing. And I can't quite put my finger on why I became happier. Like, I can't say like, oh yeah, like X, Y, and Z, I did X, Y, and Z, and bingo, there was the cause and effect, I got happier. but I put together this, I can look back and see the conditions were there that allowed for something to mature or bubble up or flower inside that helped me to become happier. And then, you know, it's, in my situation, it's like over and over again, things in the world responded to me as I practiced. People were kinder. Opportunities opened up for me that wouldn't have opened up if I hadn't been practicing. Now, maybe if I had done something completely different, maybe other opportunities would have opened up. And that maybe, I don't know, it's hard to know, right? You know, we don't have a reference point for if we make different choices in our life. Like if I led my life this way versus that way, I don't have a, what's it called in when they do experiments? It's called the control. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a control person for our lives? You go try that out. And then come back and tell me. And so all this is leading up to a point I wanted to make, and that is one of the more spiritual, perhaps religious, movements in Buddhism is called refuge. Sometimes called going for refuge. It's on my mind. It's on my heart right now because last Wednesday evening we had a refuge ceremony here at IMC. And it's one of the primary kind of, well, certainly here at IMC, it's like high church for us. We don't do so, we do so little of this stuff, but it's a beautiful expression of people's involvement and appreciation and meaning they find in their Buddhist practice in Buddhism. And the way that I offer the ceremony here, when I offer it, is I try very carefully to explain that I'm not giving people something. Like, now you're going to become a Buddhist. Now you got to, you know, here are the creeds, here are the rules. This is not what you got to do. You know, go for refuge, and you have to kind of shoehorn yourself into what it means to be a Buddhist or something. But rather, it's the opposite of that, and that is that if something meaningful, that's as people practice, they discover something meaningful for themselves. And that which is meaningful, what the results, what arises from doing the practice, as it begins to change us and touch us, and something we deeply appreciate, as it becomes more and more valuable for us, then the Buddhism, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, become a mirror for that, become a reference point for that, become a symbol for what's happening within us. And it's nice, and so the ceremony is a time to celebrate, to appreciate, to affirm, to recognize that the person has discovered something that's meaningful for them personally, and for some reason they see it in these symbols we have, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, these things. And so we have the ceremony to do that together. It's very nice. And as we had it here, and I was very touched by people going through it and their feelings of it. So because it's still in my heart, I wanted to talk a little bit about refuge, a little bit more. And then maybe we can take some questions. The way that the refuge ceremony, or the refuge, going for refuge, is worded, it's a particular way of wording it. It says, I go for refuge in the Buddha. I go for refuge in the Dharma. I go for refuge in the Sangha. And the word for go in Pali is gacchami. Gacchami, at least, you know, I don't know Pali so well, but the dictionaries and the ancient commentaries say that the word gacchami, which literally means to walk or to go, also means to understand. And so an important part of this going for refuge, going for support, is to understand something. And the question is, what is it we understand? And in the Buddhist tradition, the ideal thing to understand, if you go for refuge, is you understand how the practice works in your own heart, in your own mind. And it's not so complicated. It's actually explicitly talked about this in the ancient texts, that it's not so complicated. They don't say it that way, but what they say is that if your mind or your heart is afraid, and you're able through the practice to drop the fear, then you know something. If your mind is filled with greed, and you feel the pain of that, and you're able to drop the greed, and feel the mind without greed, feel that peaceful mind that's not consumed by greed, you know something. If you have hate, or cynicism, or envy, or jealousy, or, you know, all these kinds of emotional attitudes, motivations, which are painful to have, especially when they're strong, and you feel that pain, and somehow through the practice of mindfulness, of concentration, of compassion, you're able to let it soften and let go and drop away, maybe temporarily, you know something. You know the difference between a mind which is caught or involved in churning away in painful ways versus a mind that's not. And that's the key thing to know. That's what we can know. For people who really get a taste of it, can be very, very meaningful. It becomes the orientation about how they want to live. Not necessarily what they do with their lives, but how they want to do whatever they're doing. That they want to live their lives with a heart, with a mind, which is not contracted, which is not caught up and afraid and greedy or hateful or spiteful. A heart which is peaceful and happy and gentle or soft, or I don't know what language works for you. Some of you hear soft and gentle and you roll your eyes. But, you know, there's so many wonderful words. Can't touch the wire. There's so many wonderful words that different people have different reference points. You use different language, different concepts to talk about what it's like when the heart and the mind is no longer caught up in fear or hate or greed, clinging, all these things. And what it says in these ancient texts is that when a person knows the difference between a mind which is caught in these painful states and the mind which is free from it, then we know something about the Buddha. Isn't that nice? Who's that Buddha guy? You know, well, how are you going to find out? There's a lot of books on biographies of the Buddha. You can read them. And you might get some sense of who this person was. But for the tradition, to really get a sense, the important way of knowing the Buddha is to know that the difference in your own mind or heart between being caught, contracted, tight, and being free. That's how you know the Buddha. That's the essence of what the Buddha is about. And this is expressed very explicitly, that when a person has faith or takes refuge in the Buddha, has faith in the Buddha, what they have faith in is not the Buddha as a person, but rather in the awakening of the Buddha, in the awakened state of that mind. And the way you have some sense of what that awakened state is like, because awakening is such a big word, right? I mean, it's kind of, you know, I've known too many Buddhists who've chased after the Shangri-La of awakening as if it was some great exalted state. Maybe it is. But maybe it's pretty simple. But there's something about, that I think is relatively ordinary. I hope all of you have had some taste of this sometime in your life, of being consumed in some way in your mind by something suffering, some pain, really painful. And then something happened, and whatever it was that you were consumed by dropped away or fell away. And you felt the contrast between being caught and not being caught. That is pointing to a mind of awakening. Perhaps that mind of awakening of a Buddha has done it much more thoroughly than you've done. Maybe you did it for a few moments, or for a few hours or something. But to do it thoroughly in our lives so that it becomes pervasive is one of the, is what the Buddha represents. When I was first started meditating regularly, I didn't have that kind of language to understand what was happening to me. But I didn't have much instruction, or any instruction really, when I first started meditating. Mostly I thought, because I was doing Zen practice, my instruction that I was following was to sit down, be still with the body, and unconditionally accept whatever was going on. And I had no idea that about concentration, about, you know, anything. I didn't have any idea something was supposed to happen. I was kind of, you know, I just thought that I had some kind of faith that this was a good thing to do. So I just sat there and stayed as present as I could and tried not to be reactive to what was going on, but rather to be present for it. And as I did that, what I contributed, and that was a condition, that created a condition that allowed a different feeling inside of myself than I'd ever had before. It was very meaningful, that feeling, that sense of inner landscape of who I was. And And one of the ways I described it to myself at that time was I felt that now I had integrity. I mean, I wasn't a bad person, you know, but before that, but I felt this inner integrity, and I would go and meditate just to kind of, you know, and I didn't know how to make that feeling, whatever that feeling was, I didn't know how to make it happen. But I knew that if I sat there and did this unconditional acceptance, something would begin to change and shift and let go, and I felt this integrity or this wholeness or this completion. And it was very meaningful for me. And then about, I don't know how long it took, maybe after a year of meditating, I had this thought in meditation. And that was that the mind in meditation and the mind outside of meditation is the same mind. It's kind of arbitrary, the line between meditation and not meditation. And the next thought I had was, well, why do I only have this integrity feeling when I meditate? Shouldn't I? I'd like to have that in the rest of my life as well. You know, why just limit it? And so then, for the many years afterwards, the primary motivation for me to practice and keep practicing was not to go further or deeper in meditation, but rather was to somehow try to live this in my life as well. So in that situation, I called it integrity. But I knew something that became a central central guiding feature of my life to do that. And so I found myself then going to live in Buddhist centers because I thought, well, there you can get help in doing it all the time. And what I came to appreciate is that I could take refuge, or I could go for support, or I could rely on that integrity, or that letting go, or that sense of unconditional acceptance, or the Dharma. That there were so many times where I couldn't figure out what to do. I didn't know find my way out of the situation. I couldn't solve the problems I had. But if I sat and meditated, more often than not, my problems didn't get solved, they dissolved. Isn't that nice? Wouldn't you rather have your problems dissolved than solved? I don't know if you're now, you know, most of, you know, it wasn't like I had problems with the IRS coming after me. You know, you sit there and those problems would dissolve. It wasn't like that, but it was my inner psychological hang-ups and problems and my suffering and my angst and my fears and my guilts. And I mean, I was a handful. And you know, that's really where, you know, my challenges were. And so I found that this, a lot of those things that I'd been years trying to solve, as I entered into this Dharma practice, they dissolved. They dissolved. And that was very reassuring that I didn't have to solve them. Because solving is overrated. I mean, you know, how many of your psychological problems have you solved lately? So I came to a point where this idea of the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha was a refuge, was a support, was an inspiration, was something I felt like I could rely on, became more and more important for me. So the Buddha represents our capacity for this awakened mind, or this free mind, or, you know, some kind of way of, you know, when we see this difference between two different ways of being in the mind, being caught and not caught. The Dharma, the word Dharma is an interesting word because it comes from the root word to support, to hold up, to bear. So it's that which supports us in our lives. And so Buddhism offers a number of conditions that can support us if we engage in those conditions. And the primary one is the Eightfold Path that is offered over and over again by the tradition. That if you can live, the Eightfold Path involves having a certain understandings. Certain understandings are really helpful. So one of the understandings, the first step of the Eightfold Path is a very particular kind of understanding that without believing in this understanding, you can't practice, really go far in Buddhism. So you've got to believe in something. And this is this thing. This is the thing you have to believe in. And without believing in this, you can't be a Buddhist. So you're ready for the creed. And that is that if you cling, you'll suffer. And if you let go of that clinging, that suffering goes away. Isn't that a nice thing to believe in? And the reason why it's important to believe in, because that's the guideline for finding the path of freedom. If what you want is the freedom from clinging, you have to have some way to find it and understand it. So if you cling, you'll suffer. And so, and if you let go of that clinging, your suffering will go away. That's a reworking of the Four Noble Truths. So with that or as an orientation, then the Eightfold Path says it really helps if you create the condition. One of the three conditions to create then following that is to be kind, to be compassionate, and don't cling to a lot of things. So then it says it's really good to be ethical. Be concerned by how you speak. Pay attention to how you speak. Learn about how you speak and learn about the impact your speech has on the world and on yourself. And as you learn that, become sensitive to the cause, the effect of lying and other forms of inappropriate or painful speech. And then see if you can practice right speech, good speech, helpful speech. Your actions. It really helps if you want to wake up, if you want to find this inner integrity, if you want to find this peace, if you want to find liberation. It really helps a lot if you stop killing other people. You know, just if you're doing that, just cut it out. You know, I mean, I know Buddhism has these really heavy, heavy things to tell you to do. You've got to do these things or else. But, you know, you just got to cut out the killing. And the stealing. And harming other people with your sexuality. These things just don't go, are not compatible. Those create the wrong conditions. But if you respect and care for life, if you respect and care for people's possessions, if you respect and care for people's bodies, their hearts, their inner life, then you wouldn't do those things. And those create very different conditions over time or in the present moment. And then it's the Eightfold Path says it makes a big difference if you have what's called the right livelihood. If you how you live your life, a livelihood that, you know, it seems basically ethical, it makes a big difference that it feels unethical. Go to work every day and you feel you're doing unethical things. That creates a very different condition, very different, you know, especially over the long term. You know, remember the parallel lines? You know, maybe, you know, the first day of going to work and it feels unethical. You know, you can get away with it. This doesn't feel like no big deal. And everyone else here at work is doing it too. But, you know, over time, a toll will take and that line will go further and further away from the center. So I don't want to go into more of the Eightfold Path, but this Eightfold Path is, you know, that's the Dharma. That's the heart of, you know, the Dharma practice that supports us. And then the third of the refuges is Sangha. For those of you who don't know what that word is, it means the community of practitioners. And in particular, what the heart of what Sangha means is those practitioners who have seen the difference, who really know for their own self in some very deep, profound way the difference between being caught and being not caught. And from that, really know it's better not to be caught. And they've witnessed that, they've experienced that, they know that as a possibility. And perhaps not just a kind of in the mild kind of letting go, but in some very profound, deep way, a letting go of some of the very deepest things that we're caught up in, we get caught in, that are so deep and subtle that we don't always know that they're operating, but they're like the tradition calls it the roots, or the underpinnings for a lot of other things we do. And one of them is attachment or clinging to self, egotism. Being self-centered, and to really kind of really see that, really see that to the root, to the base, and be able to experience for oneself the difference between being caught up in self and being free of that caught-upness is one of the remarkable things, to really know that difference, to know it clearly and fully, so that in the future we're much less likely to be fooled back into selfishness, or taking something to itself. So, so to take refuge in the Sangha is to find support, inspiration, guidance in the people who somehow have gone in the path before you and know something about this, have confidence in it, exhibit the life that's lived that way. Because, you know, if you want to follow a path, it's good to know their models of people who are further ahead and can offer support. So then refuge, sarana. So it's buddham, saranam, gacchami. So gacchami means to go, but it also means to understand something. So it's not, you know, so it's this kind of it's an act of faith, statement of faith in Buddhism. They say, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. But it's faith that's built on knowledge, something we know. That's the ideal thing. And so it requires knowing something. It requires having confidence or looking back at our own experience, being present enough to be able to track ourselves, to really see there are different modes of being, different ways of being, and that one has more meaning, more value than another. So this last word, gacchami, means to go or to understand. The middle word, saranang, means, usually translated in English as a refuge. Sometimes as a protection. It's said by the tradition, it's that which helps you drop fear. When you have sarana, when you go for a refuge, then you're no longer afraid. And this is one of the experiences I've had, this idea of refuge, all this practice in Buddhism, that it's given me a lot of confidence in just being alive. I don't feel as much fear as I used to. Not that I know how to find my way, but rather I know how to find myself all the time. I know how to come back to myself. And find how to be peaceful, how not to be, or more importantly, how not to be caught in whatever circumstance I'm in. And so terrible things can happen to people, and I have confidence that if terrible things happen to me, if I suddenly get cancer or some terrible thing that shouldn't happen, it'd be nice if these things don't happen, I have a confidence in this practice that I have. Confidence in these values I've discovered through this practice. I have this confidence that I feel like one of the things I've been given through this Dharma practice is, and I don't know, I mean, I can't speak with too much confidence what I'm about to say. But I feel confident, but I'm smart enough to know that I shouldn't be. But I have confidence that I have the Dharma, I have this practice to take with me to meet my death. My dying. And so I don't feel that afraid of dying because I have this wonderful thing, that this skill, this ability, this understanding to look back at myself and find where the place of peace is. Or again, I keep wanting to correct myself, not find a place of peace, which might be the result, but I think it's more powerful and more significant to say, to find the place of not being caught. Because that's really the issue, not being caught. If peace becomes held up on the pedestal, it's too easy to become into problems. Like you're looking for the peace, we want the peace, we measure ourselves by the peace, we want to prove ourselves by the peace, all the peace becomes a thing. But let the peace take care of itself. It's quite content, it's happy. But your job is to focus on the clinging, the cautness, the tightness, the constriction that comes. And so to have confidence that you have a path, even if you don't get very far, to know you have a path to walk, to help release these inner constrictions and tightness, to dissolve these things, is one of the great, great things of a human life, to have a path, to have a practice for this. And so I feel like Buddhism has given me this wonderful practice and this path. And it's because of this path and practice that I have confidence in that I can say, how do I say this? Cautiously confident. Or provisionally confident. I'm provisionally confident. Maybe then I can say it accurately. I'm provisionally confident, because I don't really know what's going to happen, but when that time comes, but provisionally confident I have support for me when I face a crisis like dying. Isn't that nice? So refuge. So Buddhists will say, I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. And I take refuge in the Sangha. And it's nice to have ceremonies. It's nice to chant those things or to say those things periodically, be reminded, because it's so easy to forget. And there's something about stating it to oneself or clearly and unequivocally that reminds us, which kind of evokes those states or evokes that path or evokes our deep appreciation or value that we have in these things. And it's good to kind of get reconnected in a deep way. Our lives are busy, we get distracted, and then I take refuge in the Buddha. Ah, I take refuge in the Dharma. Ah, yes. I take refuge in the Sangha. Yes. However, it usually doesn't work that quickly. That's why the tradition, when they chant the refuges, they do it three times. By the third time, maybe it sinks in. So, I thought I'd have more time for questions, but you have anything you want to ask about that today? Was that too religious of a talk for those of you who don't want religion? Or was it not religious enough for those of you who want more religion around here? It's very hard to be a Dharma teacher, you know, all these competing wishes out there. So, any questions or comments?
Thank you for your integrity.
Oh, thank you. Yes?
Do we have time to chant them?
Oh, do we have time to chant them? Do people want to get to chant them?
Yes.
How many of you don't know them, the chant in Pali? That's a lot. So those of you, why don't we do it call and response? So I'll chant one word, and then you repeat after me. And we'll do as I told you, we'll do it three times, right? So the first time we'll do call and response. The second time you say in Pali for the second time. And that word is dutiyampi. And then the third time you say for a third time, and that the ancient language is tatiyampi. So so the first time you say Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami. And then you say the same thing all over again but with the preface dutiyampi and tatiyampi. Got it? So we'll do the first time, every word, call and response. And then the second time, I'll do the whole line, and then you repeat after me, each line. And the third time, we'll do it all together. And if you don't have it by the third time, that's fine. It's you can just hum along. And you don't have to do this, but it's the custom often when we do this to put our hands together in Anjali like this. And that's just only if you want to. It's just like a completely no requirement. And repeat these words. Buddham. Saranang.
Saranang.
Gacchami.
Gacchami.
Dhammang saranang gacchami,
sangham
saranam gacchami. Then repeat after me the whole line. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami.
Dhyami Sangam Saranam Gacchami.
Then all together. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangam Saranam Gacchami. Thank you. That was nice. So I hope that the Buddha becomes just a mirror of what you see in yourself. Thank you.